Okay, we'll get started. Thanks very much, everybody. And hello. My name is John Phillimore. I'm the Executive Director of the John Curtin Institute of Public Policy here at Curtin. And I'm very delighted to welcome you all here today. Apologies for the late change of venue for some of you. We decided it wasn't fair if you were if our speaker was next to the Ellington Jazz Band, which was actually just sitting up there in the lecture theatre next to where we were going to be, and we thought that probably wouldn't be the right thing to do. I mean, Richard, you've got to sing for your supper, but it's getting ridiculous, I reckon. So we've moved 20 metres over here, so it's great for you to come over here. Thanks very much. Can I just begin by asking people, can you please turn off your mobile phones, put them on silent? You don't want to be the ones embarrassed when the phone rings at that critical point. Thanks very much. Okay, now. Okay, that's great. Where's our... Let's have a look. I don't think that's the case, but maybe they heard me complaining about... Maybe the software counterfeiting is what happened when we did the room bookings. Anyway, so, the serious stuff. I'd like to acknowledge, of course, the traditional owners of the land, the Noongar people, and pay my respects to their elders past and present. And Curtin, of course, has a very proud history of working with Aboriginal people. I think the highest percentage or highest number of Aboriginal students of any university, and so we really are always very cognizant of that fact. The JCIPP is a research institute in the Curtin Business School, and we conduct research and lead debate and discussion on important public policy issues. And a key part of what we do is to bring speakers of national and state renown to the Curtin and West Australian communities to speak on topical issues, and of course today is absolutely no exception. We have had previous leaders of the Greens, Senator Bob Brown and Senator Christine Milne, speak at JCIPP public forums in the past, as well as other senators such as Senator Rachel Seward, who's here today, Senator Scott Ludlam and Senator Sarah Hanson-Young. So it's really pleasing that Senator Dina Talley is able to follow in their footsteps. I'm also very pleased that Senator Dina Talley's presentation today will move beyond what some might see as the more traditional turf for the Greens, for a Greens leader, by addressing the issue of the health system, which is so important to all our lives. JCIPP has previously hosted a number of state and federal health ministers at public forums like this, and most recently the current federal health minister, Susan Lee, spoke last year at one of our forums soon after her appointment. Curtin, of course, has a very extensive involvement in health education and research. The Faculty of Health Sciences boasts the widest scope of practitioner training for health professionals in WA, with over 12,000 students, and Curtin educates more health professionals than any other WA tertiary institution. And we're also at the forefront of innovative course delivery in health. We were the first in Australia to introduce an interprofessional education curriculum so that all first-year Curtin Health Science students complete a common set of core units, including a core unit on Indigenous culture and health. And of course our new Curtin Medical School will be commencing next year. Curtin's also at the forefront of health research. The Faculty of Health Sciences includes renowned national centres in drug research, public health advocacy and evidence, accident research and biosciences through the Curtin Health Innovation Research Institute. Curtin Business School, where I'm from, also has expertise in health economics, supported by the Bankwest Curtin Economic Centre, and in federal-state relations, which is a crucial aspect of health policy, and we may even get some questions or discussion about that with our speaker. So, to our speaker, let's say a few words quickly about Richard. He's the leader of the Australian Greens, as you all know, and he was elected to the federal parliament in 2010 as the Greens' first Victorian senator. He narrowly missed out in 2007, and he was also pipped in elections for the state seat of Melbourne before that. He was elected unopposed of the Greens in May last year after the resignation of Christine Milne. Prior to entering Parliament, Richard was a general practitioner, a public health specialist. He did medical degrees at Monash and master's degrees in public health and health sciences at La Trobe. He worked in Aboriginal health in the Northern Territory, on HIV prevention in India, and in the drug and alcohol sector. So clearly he has a very long-standing involvement in the health issues. He's deputy chair, in fact, of the Senate Committee into Health,
and he's also the co-convener of the Parliamentary Friends for Drug Policy and Law Reform, the Parliamentary Friends of West Papua, and Parliamentary Friends of Medicine. He's the son of two Italian migrants, and he grew up in Melbourne, but lives with his wife and two sons on a working farm in Victoria's Otway Range. He played VFA football for 6 years. His website says that he's a long-suffering Richmond Tigers supporter. Perhaps you can stay in Perth until Friday night to watch Richmond play the West Coast Eagles, Richard. I'm not sure how much suffering that might involve and on whose behalf, but you can stay along a few more days if you like. So today, of course, Richard's going to speak to the topic of our health system is our value system. So please join with me in welcoming Senator Richard Niedertali.
Thanks very much. Thank you for that very generous introduction, John. It's a real pleasure to be here, following on from the footsteps of my predecessors, Bob and Christine, of course, other Green senators, and it's a great privilege to be here with Senator Rachel Seward, who's our wonderful Western Australian senator and doing so much great work representing really, or being the voice for people in the Australian nation who don't have a voice. So good on you, Rach. I want to talk a little bit about the Australia's health system. I'm going to try and keep it relatively brief. I'm more than happy to answer questions at the end on any aspect of health policy or indeed any political questions you might have for me. I want to start by acknowledging the traditional owners, the Whadjuk Noongar people, and I want to pay my respects to their elders past and present. So I think Australia's health system is pretty good. We've got a good health system in general terms. Most people can get good health care when they need it. There are some obvious exceptions. Clearly, the most obvious of those is the huge health inequity that exists with our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, where the gap in life expectancy and a whole range of indicators is really a source of national shame. And it was with mixed feelings that we were in Parliament launching the 10th anniversary of the latest closing of the gap report, which showed on some indicators some improvement, but still far too much work to be done. The fact that we do enjoy in large part good health is in part a function of our health system, but it's also a function of the nation's egalitarian traditions, and the social model of health is really important to understand why it's not just access to decent health care that shapes the health of a nation. It's access to education, employment opportunities, housing and so on, the so-called social model of health. And in terms of my own experience, having spent a couple of years working, firstly here in Carnarvon in the Aboriginal Health Service, it was my first job out of once I left the hospital system while I was travelling here, and of course that for me was something that led me on a path to working in Aboriginal communities in the Northern Territory for a few years. And for me that was a very formative experience because it was really a recognition and understanding that, sure, being able to provide healthcare is important, but it's only one of those factors that's going to help us to bridge the gap in health inequalities that exist in Australia. And unless we do something about education, employment, housing and so on, then we won't make the progress that's so desperately needed. And it really was that journey that led me into this role. And some people often say to me, well, how is it that you ended up, you know, going from a profession like medicine to where, as people keep reminding me, is one of the most respected professions in the world, to the profession I now enjoy, which is somewhere along used car salesman. But I think there's, I mean, I look at, there was a very famous German physician called Rudolf Virchow, who was one of those polymaths, you know, he was an anthropologist, a physician, a pathologist, a biologist, a writer, and he became a politician, and he said something that really stuck with me, and he said that medicine is a social science and politics is nothing else but medicine on a large scale. If medicine is to fulfil her great task, then she must enter the political and social life. The physicians are the natural attorneys of the poor, and the social problems should largely be solved by them. And that sort of reflects how I feel about the profession that I trained in and the work that I now do. So as I said, it is our health, the health that we enjoy is in large part because of those important traditions, but also because we have had a long battle to implement universal healthcare into this country. And they are, that was a very hard-fought battle. And one of the things I've learnt doing this job is that those battles are never truly won. And I feel that we're in the middle of a fight again around how we continue to ensure that universal healthcare is a cornerstone of our health system. And I think it is being slowly eroded. It's being eroded because there's some challenges. There's no question that health costs are increasing. If you look in dollar terms, Australia's health spending as a proportion of GDP went from about 6.5% in the 90s. It's now around 9.5% or a little over that. And if you project into the future, it looks like our expenditure will increase by about another percent over the next decade. And there are a range of factors around that. What you keep hearing is that it's a function of the ageing population, and it's true, the ageing population is one of those factors. But actually, when you look at this issue in detail, it is a much smaller factor compared to increasing access to new healthcare technologies. So the biggest driver for increasing healthcare costs is not the ageing population, it's the fact that we are getting new technologies, that is medicines, diagnostic procedures, new treatments, being made available all of the time. And what we're really facing is a question about whether we're able to fund access to those new technologies, those technologies that really are, will help us live longer and healthier lives, providing that we're funding the right ones. Now, of course, you know, the narrative that's emerging at the moment is that we've got ageing population, healthcare spiralling out of control. The only way to deal with this problem is to rein in costs. And so we had, through the 2014 budget, two really key measures, one of which got a lot of publicity at the time, and that was the changes to Medicare. The government's argument, we can't continue to afford universal healthcare, we need to implement, we now will introduce a system of co-payments, and those co-payments are important to try and ensure that people aren't over utilising GP services in particular. Of course, the problem with that argument is that that co-payment impacts on those people who can least afford to pay. Because, firstly, if you come from a low socioeconomic background, you're more likely to have a higher burden of disease. And, of course, you're also somebody who's going to be least able to be able to afford to pay those for those services. The problem with co-payments highlights one of the big problems within the health system is that what it will do will shift that burden onto the acute health sector, largely the hospital system, which is a much more expensive way of providing those services. And of course, it makes sense when you consider the divided responsibilities that exist within the health system. That is that largely it is the federal government that's responsible for the provision of primary care services, and it's state governments that are largely responsible for the funding of our hospital system. Some work was done to try and deal with that issue through the previous Labor government, and it wasn't perfect, but it certainly was progress. What the Labor government at the time did was acknowledge that if we continue to have this artificial division within the health system where we've got two funders funding different parts of the system, the incentive to shift costs from one part to the other part will continue. And so what was introduced was a federal funding formula to try and ensure that we had the federal government with some responsibility for the hospital system. So the funding formula that was developed was that for future growth, that the federal government would be responsible for a proportion of the payment of those services. And so the second thing that was in that, the second big change in that 2014 Abbott budget that was so poorly received was really abolishing that formula, saying it's no longer our responsibility, or if it is, we'll only do it through block payments to state governments. And that was the old way of funding our hospitals. You'd have this sort of argy-bargy between state and federal governments, states asking for money, federal government effectively saying, well, we'll pay you what we think we need to pay you. And that's where we're having this debate at the moment about the amount of money that's been withdrawn from the public hospital system, because based on the projections under the old funding formula, with population growth and a range and health inflation, we were seeing a trajectory that's not being matched by current payments. And it was one of the big changes that wasn't just a problem because it was federal government withdrawing money from our hospital system, but it was working against where the direction of health policy had been going for many years, and that was to try and resolve this issue of divided responsibilities and ensuring that the Commonwealth government had some skin in the game. Now, what sits underneath that is this notion that, certainly under the current government, that healthcare is a cost, healthcare costs are spiralling out of control, and the only way we can ensure that we deal with it is by cutting spending. Now, we have a different view, and I think many health economists share our view, and that is regarding health as not just a cost, but as an investment. If the problem that we're facing right now is a problem of people being given the choice between reining in our spending but denying ourselves the opportunity to access new healthcare technologies, medicines, diagnostic procedures and treatments that are going to help us live longer and healthier lives, or raising revenue to fund those things, well, we sit on that side of the equation rather than on the other side of the equation. And it's actually a view that's shared by most Australians. When you look at poll after poll that have been conducted, what you see is people supporting an increased revenue in order to pay for healthcare, because it makes sense. If, to use economic jargon, healthcare is described as a superior good. That is, as people's income level increases, what you see is those individuals spending more on healthcare. They regard that as an important function of increasing revenue, and it becomes an increasing part of their expenditure. Now, why as a government should we not be reflecting those values that most people hold? Why should we be seeing the increased expenditure in health as a burden to be reined in? And what happens in this debate, sadly, is that what we get is we get the notions of efficiency and getting value for money out of our healthcare spend confused with the notion of sustainability. Now, something's sustainable if you choose to sustain it. If you choose to spend and invest money in healthcare, then it will be sustainable. It will be sustainable if you choose to raise revenue from other parts of the economy to fund decent healthcare. It won't be sustainable if you decide that you don't think it's a priority to fund. Getting value for money out of our healthcare dollars is a very separate question. Now, we, in general terms, do quite well out of that, but we could do better. One of the things that we need to do is ensure we get value out of our Medicare benefits schedule. It's basically, for those people who don't know how it works, it's effectively a list of item numbers with a funding amount next to it that hasn't been reviewed for a long time and hasn't kept up with changes in technologies. So it's our view that a review of the MBS schedule is long overdue, and what we need to do is acknowledge the fact that some technologies have moved along very, very quickly, and they were funded at a time when it might have taken you an hour to do a procedure, and now, because of advancing technology, it can take you 10 minutes. And that's why we see the huge disparity between the different medical disciplines in terms of remuneration. So a review of the MBS is a good idea, something that should be led by clinicians, and there is an understanding within the medical community that unless we do this, what we're going to see is governments put downward pressure on health spending through other mechanisms that are much less rational. What we're seeing at the moment, for example, is a freezing of the MBS so that services for general practice, indeed all services, is now indexation has been frozen, which effectively amounts to a pay cut for those people providing those services. So it is our view that what we need to do is try and ensure that we get good value for money out of our healthcare system, and that what we also need to be doing is looking at ensuring that we raise revenue to be able to pay for the sort of services that we know Australians want and deserve. So let's go to that question of how do we make health spending more efficient? Well, I think what we need to do is return to the funding formula that was introduced under the previous Labor government, where there's a split between Commonwealth and federal governments in terms of funding our hospitals, and ensuring that there's an incentive for federal government not to shift costs onto the much more expensive hospital sector. And we should enshrine that formula in law. One of the problems, of course, is that that formula was open to changes in the budget because it didn't require any legislative instrument to change it. The other thing that we need to do is look at our primary health system. Our primary health system, that is first GPs, allied health professionals, nurses and so on within the community, is the most cost-effective way of delivering healthcare services. It's not just cost-effective, it's good for patients. If we can treat somebody in the community, we're ensuring that we put downward pressure on costs and we also are providing healthcare in an environment that is often safer than providing healthcare within a hospital. Sometimes hospitals are the worst place to be if you're unwell. It's one of the paradoxes. So how do we do that? Well, there's been a number of reports in this area. The Grattan Institute, I commend that a report of reform of the primary care sector to you. What it does is it talks about a better way of delivering services through primary care. One of the big problems we've got within our primary care system is that it is largely fee-for-service, or almost entirely fee-for-service, and what it rewards is throughput rather than outcomes. And what we need to do is start shifting that balance so that we're not just rewarding our healthcare providers for throughput, for just service delivery, but for quality outcomes. And there's a little bit of that within our primary care system. There are practice incentive payments that reward general practices for immunisation services and other things. But if you look at the mix that exists in other nations like New Zealand, the UK and so on, they are much better at this than we are. There was an attempt to try and do that through primary care or through GP care plans. In some areas they've worked well, but largely they haven't achieved the objectives that they were set out to achieve, and that was to try and ensure better coordination of care. And when you consider the burden of chronic disease that is coming down the line through diseases such as ischemic heart disease, diabetes, lung disease, and so on, unless we get better at managing chronic disease within the community, then what we're going to see is a huge impost on our hospital sector, again, the most expensive and least effective way of dealing with that problem. So getting coordinated care through our primary health system is a vital area for reform. And you know you've got a problem when someone's diagnosed with diabetes and there's only a 50% chance that they will have referrals that are necessary to manage the complications that arise from someone with diabetes. So if you're diagnosed with diabetes, there should be referral to see an eye specialist or to have an eye screen, prevent diabetic retinopathy, a preventable cause of blindness. You know that someone should be referred for a neurovascular check to prevent peripheral vascular disease, again, a common cause of foot amputations. We've got one of the highest rates of amputations in the developed world for people with diabetes because we don't do that well. Referrals, or at least screening for kidney disease, again, not done well. And that's a function of a primary care system that's not working properly. So there's some areas where we can ensure that we get good value for money. We also should understand that the provision, or having universal health care, the provision of a publicly funded health system in the way that we, at least notionally, have structured our health system, succeeds on that measure of getting good value for money, as well as ensuring that you get efficiencies within the system. So you look at nations like the US, which spend about 17% of their GDP on healthcare. They have much worse health outcomes, and they pay a lot more for them. You look at those countries around the world, the UK, NZ, and so on, which have a very different model, premised on universal healthcare through collective taxation, and what you see is both efficiencies and fairness in the system. UK spends roughly 8% of their GDP on healthcare, much better outcomes than the US, who spend double what the UK do. So acknowledging that having universal healthcare, and one of the reasons it works is because Medicare, which is effectively a universal health insurance scheme, is able to put downward pressure on the cost of health services. And you just need to look at what happens within the private system to know that having Medicare as a monopoly insurer provides downward pressure on the costs of healthcare. One of the other things that we need to recognise is that there is capacity within the private system, significant capacity. A lot of our services are delivered within private hospitals and within the private system. But we have introduced a set of policies that recognise that we need to use that capacity in the private system, but instead of funding those services directly, what we do is we subsidise the uptake of private health insurance. That has been a public policy disaster. What the subsidies that go into private health insurance do is they, firstly, they're inflationary. You've got the health insurers who know that every time they increase the premiums, it will be the government, the taxpayer, that foots a third of the bill. So it's an inflationary policy. It is hugely inequitable. So what you have is 50% of the community with private health insurance, you have the other 50% of the community who are effectively subsidising the uptake of that private health insurance. And research shows that if you spent the money, and it's $6 billion and growing per annum on the private health insurance subsidy, directly on service provision, you get a return of about 2.5 to 1. Now, it's very difficult, politically unpopular, to talk about winding back a rebate to somebody who's got private health insurance. Understand that. But the fact that it's politically unpopular doesn't mean it's the right policy lever. It was introduced with a view to ensuring that we take the pressure of our public hospital system. That was the rationale given by John Howard at the time of the introduction of that policy. It has failed spectacularly to do what was its primary aim, and that is take pressure off our public hospital system. It doesn't do it because many policyholders who have got private health insurance still use the public system. They choose to do it because they don't want to be faced with out-of-pocket costs, often inherent within the private system. They do it often because the cases might be complex, difficult, and they're best treated in a tertiary treating hospital. It's inequitable because you have a system of let me give you an example. So our view is that we need to phase out the private health insurance rebate and have that money going directly towards service provision. We had somebody contact our office and say, I think that's grossly unfair. If it wasn't for private health insurance, I wouldn't have been able to get braces for my two kids. It was the thing that made the difference in being able to afford dental care. Now, we have to ask ourselves as a nation, is it fair that someone living in Broadmeadows who doesn't have private health insurance should be subsidising the cost of someone else's private health insurance who lives in the leafy eastern suburbs of Melbourne so that that person can afford to get dental care for their children? It's a very inequitable way of funding healthcare. So it fails on the grounds of efficiency and equity. And if that money was put directly into service provision, in our view, as it should be, for example, we'd like to see an expansion of publicly funded dental care. One of the things that we negotiated through our agreement with the Labor Party was a Medicare entitlement for young kids, so that there's $1,000 for a child under the age of 18 to go and get publicly funded dental care through the Medicare system. Our view is that, again, based on that notion of efficiency and equity, that needs to be the approach that we take when it comes to funding healthcare. The question that's often asked, though, is if you're calling for an increased investment in healthcare, how are you going to pay for it? And we've got a very straightforward view on that question. We have, as a nation, huge tax concessions that disproportionately benefit people on high incomes, and we want to stop them. So we have tax concessions through the superannuation system, through the property market. We have tax concessions given to mining companies through things like the diesel fuel rebate. And of course, then we have the issue of tax avoidance and tax evasion. And it's through a combination of those measures that we believe that we can raise the revenue to ensure that we fund and invest more in a very efficient and equitable public health system. There are a few more things I'll say, and then I'll throw it open to questions. In our discussion around healthcare, as I said, we think that oral healthcare is one of the areas that, as a nation, and you compare us to other OECD countries, we underinvest in. And we made this ridiculous decision with the introduction of Medicare, and it's a historical one, that somehow the mouth should be treated separately from the rest of the body, and as a result we'll have a completely different way of funding it. And the outcome of that is that almost half of the Australian community defer getting oral health treatment because of cost. And the impact of poor oral health on general health and wellbeing is significant. It leads to a whole range of serious health complications. I won't go into the associations between heart disease, antenatal complications, and so on, as a result of poor oral health. Not to mention the huge social stigma that exists when you present for a job interview or to try and get a property on the housing market, if you're trying to get to rent a house, and you've got very poor oral health. It's a social marker, and it puts people behind the eight ball in all of those important areas. And we think, again, if we've got universal health care, well, that should extend to oral health as well. We've been leading the debate on drug reform and ensuring that we start to look at the issue of illicit drug use as a health issue rather than as a law and order issue. Very good evidence from around the world about sensible, evidence-based reforms that we know would allow us to spend, again, our efforts that go towards reducing drug use and keeping people safe in a way that means we're able to afford treatment for anybody who needs it, and we have a policy that's indeed based on evidence rather than on what we have at the moment, which is really a policy that reflects attitudes that I think belong in the last century. The link between climate change and health is a serious one, and we need to start acknowledging that if we don't address the issue of global warming, then what we're also doing is imposing huge costs on the health system down the track. Extreme weather, all of the things that come from that in terms of fires, floods and so on, and the health impacts that flow, agriculture becoming more and more marginal, the mental health implications on people who live in those environments all need to be dealt with urgently. We need to get better at just investing in prevention. We had one of the first acts of this government, which was to abolish the Preventive Health Agency. I mean, how on earth a government that spruiks its economic credentials could make an argument that taking money away from the most cost-effective investment in the health system, which is prevention, is economically rational, is beyond me. One of the problems, of course, with prevention is that it requires a long-term focus. Most of these investments don't accumulate within electoral cycles. They can take 5 and 10 and 20 years to accumulate, and unfortunately we have politicians who are boxed in by what is going to help them in their next election campaign. And of course the other problem is that the most important advocates of prevention are those people who don't know that they've in fact benefited from a prevention intervention. If you've waited for 6 hours in an emergency department, you know about it. But if as a result of reduced salt in foods, or indeed reduced sugar consumption, you don't know that in fact you've been the beneficiary of that, and that you're one of the numbers of people who have avoided a heart attack as a result of that intervention. And of course that's one of the problems with prevention, and it's why we don't have a constituency arguing strongly in favour of it. We've managed to achieve a few big things, despite the fact that one of the things that people often ask us is, yeah, that's all really good, we like your vision, but you're not in government, what are you going to achieve? We've had a debate around medicinal cannabis in this country, and we've made serious progress, and I have to say it's been because we have been the engine rooms of that change. I can talk you through that story and how that's evolved, but we're now very close to ensuring that medicinal cannabis, which has some significant therapeutic benefits for people in palliative care, chemotherapy-induced nausea, muscle spasms from things like multiple sclerosis, will now be able to access that as a medicine. Still some work to be done, but significant progress on that front. So I'll just finish by saying, you know, if I was to summarise our attitude to health, it is we need to start getting away from this notion that healthcare is a cost that we can no longer afford. These are value judgments. We have a choice. We can give people access to new healthcare technologies if we choose to do that by raising the revenue that's necessary to be able to afford them. That doesn't mean we shouldn't continue searching for more cost-effective interventions and ensuring that we get value for money out of every dollar that we spend. We need to also recognise that the one of those spends is the spend on the private health insurance rebate, and that should be redirected into the health budget so that we can get the direct provision of services. We've got to ensure that we get a much more rational system to fund our public hospitals, and that means having the Commonwealth with some skin in the game. We have to recognise that R&D, if we're talking about a smart and innovative country, that the health sector is one of those areas where the Australian economy can really benefit from. If we move away from those extractive industries of the past towards more innovation, that means a greater investment in the health and education sector. And we can be an engine room for the development of new drugs, new medicines and new technologies if we do it properly. Ultimately, as I said, we think that the job of government is to help people to live longer, healthier, happier lives. I don't know why we continue to pursue economic progress if it's not for that aim. And so that really lies at the heart of everything we're trying to do in healthcare. Happy to open it up to a few questions.
Thanks, Richard. That's great. And we've got quite a lot of time for questions. We will have we've got some refreshments and things for later on, but that's not for about half an hour yet. So you've got to think to yourself now by asking some nice, succinct questions. We've got a microphone because we are eye-lecturing this, I think. So hopefully we can actually show this on our website too. So who wants to be the first question raiser? Here we go. Andrew down here.
Thank you, Mr. Di Natale, for your presentation. Andrew Duncan from the Institute of Public Administration. I wonder if you'd reflect in regards to decriminalisation of drugs, etc., on what you know of the Portuguese experience.
Good question. So I was lucky enough to visit Portugal last year. Part of the reason for the visit was to look at what Portugal's done. For those people who don't know, in 2001, Portugal took a very bold step. They had a huge problem with heroin dependence. They had 1 in 100 people using heroin. They threw everything at it. The police locking people up, so on. Wasn't working. And there was a bipartisan consensus. They basically said, let's get some experts in the room. You tell us what we need to do. And so an independent group of experts got together and said, what we all probably, well, most of us probably know, you're targeting the wrong people. What you're doing is you're going after individual drug users who are substance dependent. You're spending a whole lot of money through policing those individuals. What you end up doing is clogging up your courts, the criminal justice system, and then when those people need treatment, you haven't got enough to pay for it. So they turned the whole thing on its head and they said, we are not going to continue to prosecute those individual drug users who are caught with a small quantity for possession. It is no longer a criminal offence. If your drug use is problematic, we will refer you to a panel, and that panel will refer you into treatment. At the time, it was hugely controversial. The big debate across Europe, Portugal was going to become, you know, the honeypot effect. It would drag, you know, people would come to Portugal to use drugs. It's far too permissive. What we'll see is drug use escalate in Portugal, and they were the claims. The evidence is in, and Portugal has been a huge success. What, in fact, has happened is that drug use has been relatively stable. In fact, amongst young people, it's decreased, but it's been and it's followed trends across Europe. And that doesn't surprise anybody. You would expect that if the premise is that criminal penalties don't work as a deterrent and all they do is divert resources away from treatment, then you wouldn't expect drug use to change. It was interesting, though, amongst young people, because what happened was removing those criminal penalties, taking the stigma away from the individual who uses drugs, meant that people started to have more honest conversations. There was a big drug education program in schools, and so you started to get a much more sensible discussion around drug use. Had more people in treatment, less overdoses, decreased spread of HIV and hepatitis C through injecting, and obviously more money for people in treatment when they needed it. One of the things they also did was recognise this isn't just a biomedical problem. Unless people are given support in terms of housing, employment and so on, which often lies underneath some of the issues around drug use, then we won't get very far. So they introduced a program to subsidise employers for taking on someone who'd been through drug treatment. 95% of those people were still in the same job 2 years later. Very, very effective. Because drug use is partly, particularly when you're talking about people who become dependent, it's about being disconnected from your community and from society. So it turned the whole thing on its head. And our view, and the view we've put forward, is that Australia should consider doing the same thing. We should recognise, and again, just to be clear, like it wasn't legal. The criminal penalties that were used to target individual drug users caught with small amounts, they were abolished. However, dealers continued to be prosecuted. And so it's very different from legalisation. We think it makes sense. I've been doing a series of roundtables across the country, and I have to tell you, within the drug and alcohol sector, within the policing community, there is a very, very strong appetite for us to have a different conversation. Australia used to lead the world on this stuff. Back in the 80s, needle and syringe exchange, one of the first countries that did it. Medically supervised injecting facility, again, one of the first nations. We almost had a heroin trial in 1999. A lot of public support, and in the end, it really was only the intervention of John Howard that stopped that. So we have a proud history, and I think when there's some leadership, the community can be brought with them, but that's just gone. For the last 15 years, we have really gone backwards in this area. And I think, you know, one of the things, given I've worked in the sector, is to use this role that I've been given to try and have a different conversation about it. And I've been, I have to say, incredibly humbled by the support. You know, we had one of these roundtables in the Gold Coast, and the Courier Mail decided that they wanted to come and talk to us about our policy. And the outcome of that was a front page with myself and Larissa Waters with the photo of us smoking a crack pipe, saying, you know, Loopy Green's at it again. Now, firstly, I had to explain to my mum what a crack pipe was. And then I had to explain, had to tell her what Photoshop was. And, you know, that not my crack pipe, I promise. But you know what? On the back of that, a lot of interest. We had wall-to-wall media for a couple of days, and it was really positive. I was on FM radio this morning here in Perth talking about it with people who were saying, I just thank God someone's actually having an intelligent conversation about the issue. So I think there's an appetite for change. I think what we're doing is not working. In fact, what I think we're doing is actively creating harm. Need to recognise that if you can't keep drugs out of the most heavily regulated and policed environment in the country, which is in prisons, then how on earth are you going to keep them out of kids' bedrooms? Right? So let's be smarter. Let's recognise that when someone gets into trouble with drug addiction, that the thing that we need to provide is treatment, and when they need it. If you miss that window when they come in, it's often too late. And the way to do that is to spend money where you know it works and to stop wasting money where it doesn't work.
Thank you, Richard. Chris Toomey from WACOS. I wanted to ask just quickly about the issue around social taxes, around sugar, alcohol, tobacco and so on. Mm. I was very impressed by what you said about increasing our investment in preventative health, but I'm really interested in what's the link to social taxes there, and then in particular, how do we then target some of those groups and cohorts and communities who are most at risk and are currently most missed by a lot of the preventative stuff that we've done?
Good question. I didn't talk about that, but I should have. It's a problem when you don't read the speech that your staff prepare for you. You have to ask yourself, what's the purpose of taxation to start with? And, you know, tax systems design, I think, for a few reasons. These are value judgments. People will tell you that, you'll get an economic outcome depending on how you cut taxes and where you do it, but most of this is contested. So the tax system is designed to tackle inequality. It's why we have a progressive income tax system, right? To do something about the widening gap and growing gap here in Australia between the rich and the poor. It's why we're proud supporters of a progressive taxation system. Tax is also designed to ensure you bring in revenue to fund healthcare and education. But one of the other reasons you have tax is to incentivise good behaviours and disincentivise behaviours that are destructive. It's why we supported a price on pollution. It's why we support tobacco, an increase in the tobacco excise, and we think that's a good thing. One of the issues with taxing particular behaviours is often the regressive nature of, and you have to accept that if you're talking about things like tobacco excise, it has a regressive element, which is why if you're going to do it, you have to combine it with the tax and transfer system to ensure that you address some of the regressive elements of those so-called behavioural taxes. So we support an increase in the tobacco excise, and we think that if you look at the history of tobacco control in Australia, it's a combination of measures. It is price, and price is a significant, probably the most significant factor in changing behaviour. Plain packaging, promotion and advertising, all the stuff we know from the public health community that has been effective over years. The same thing applies with alcohol. So when we look at alcohol, we've got this dog's breakfast of a taxation system around alcohol, different products taxed at different rates, and what we need to do is start having a much more rational taxation system around alcohol that's not based on a whole range of other factors. The central thing that should drive it is the content of alcohol in a beverage. And so that's what's sometimes called a volumetric tax, and we support what's called a tiered volumetric tax. That means that you tax alcohol according to the amount of alcohol that's in it. At the moment, with wine, we do the opposite. We tax it on value. So the cheaper the product, the less tax you pay, which is an incentive to make very cheap alcohol. So that's called the wine equalisation tax. That should be gone, and we should have a tiered volumetric tax. And the interesting thing that's coming up now, and of course with alcohol, the same things apply. Promotion, let's end those bombardment of alcohol ads during sport, sponsorship, availability, all of those things that we know work from a public health approach. And when it comes to sugar, I think there is a very strong argument to start looking. You know, we have obesity as one of the big challenges to tackle. It is something we need to look at systemically. This is only one small part of a suite of measures that should be implemented, but at my view, and you know, it's something that we're looking at, we're certainly looking at the evidence from other countries who have implemented it, the UK and others, is that there is a strong argument to tax sugar, particularly if you look at things like sweetened beverages, soft drinks and so on. And to ensure that money is reinvested back into the health system. I think when it's just about raising revenue rather than reinvesting it back into the health system, I think that's important for a couple of reasons. One is to build the case, you know, public support. When people know that that money is going back into the health system, then you're much more likely to build the public case for some of those taxes.
Thank you. Bruce Maycock from Public Health. I was really pleased to hear the answers to that question, but I'd just like to extend a little further. Mm. I don't think people realise how much prevention has been devastated in the last half decade. All national agreements and partnership agreements have essentially been defunded, devolved. The obesity prevention group has been devolved, etc. I'd like you to, if you could, just speak a little bit about the aspect of leadership and governance. We had a PM who had a neoliberal approach and essentially said you're all responsible as individuals regardless of what was happening with industry and policy. You've spoken a little bit about the creation of healthy public policy, not public health policy, but healthy public policy. I'm wondering if you could talk about what your vision would be around leadership and governance around prevention.
Well, that's a tough question. I mean, I hope we're showing a bit of it right now. I mean, you look at where, let me start with the commentary around current Prime Minister. I think there's the sense that we'd see a change in direction from the Prime Minister, and on so many things we haven't seen that because, I think most people know, he's beholden to those extreme right-wing, socially conservative forces within his own party, and he hasn't shown the leadership to stand up to them. And that's why I think his support is spiralling and fast. But I have to say on health, I didn't expect anything from Malcolm Turnbull. I mean, his vision is very much aligned on healthcare with the previous Prime Minister. The reason that we got into this silly debate over the last few weeks around the Prime Minister talking about funding to the state or devolving funding to the states on funding of hospitals is because he's unable to stand up and articulate his view of what a health system in Australia looks like. Because if he was to do that, he'd find himself in the same situation that Tony Abbott did. I mean, he believes very much in the notion of a user-pays system where we have lower taxes and individuals take responsibility for their health care through a largely privatised health system. Now, I know this about Malcolm Turnbull, and it is an ideological view that's not based on evidence, because we know it's a much more expensive and inequitable way of funding it. So I don't think you're going to see, I don't think his view on healthcare is informed by some of his other positions on social issues like marriage equality, where I think he actually wants marriage equality, but he's just not prepared to stand up to the people inside his party room. I think his views on health are very much aligned with the other members of his party room. So we won't see that leadership from, I think, the current Prime Minister, regardless of the outcome of the election. That whole thing around, you know, as I said, devolving to state governments was because, you know, the alternative is to stand up and say, we're not going to fund healthcare. He was a big supporter of co-payments, a big supporter of Medicare co-payments. So we won't see it from him. I think from the Labor Party, we'll see some progress, but not enough. Not enough. And certainly on some of those other issues, like drug law reform, like a greater investment in oral health, like the private health insurance rebate, who Jenny Macklin at the time said it was the worst case of public policy she'd seen in her time in the Parliament, but now will continue to be supported by the Labor Party. They made some improvements to it by means testing it, but the underlying notion that you punish people on high incomes for not having private health insurance and incentivise people on low incomes, lower incomes, to take it out actually goes against what the I think all the evidence says. I probably haven't answered your question directly enough there. Is there anything else you? I mean, specifically, I don't know how to answer a question that says, how do you create a culture of leadership except by trying to model that change? And that's part of what I suppose a discussion like this is about.
Thanks very much for a very, very cogent talk, and thanks to John for organising it. I'd just like to ask you to follow up on the question of prevention and sustainability, perhaps from a slightly broader angle. For example, are there synergies that can be gathered between the health sector, regional economies and the environment, perhaps through the production of local, sustainable, you know, high-quality foods that will help people's diets and health?
Yes.
I mean, absolutely, of course there are. And much of this work is really not done at a federal level, but most of this sort of integration is happening at a local government level and at a state government level. One of the
problems with the way health programs are administered is that very much that siloed approach. And unless we start getting more integration across planning and recognising that the environment in which people are work, live and play is one of the biggest contributors to healthcare, access to open spaces, accessible public transport, having sort of infrastructure within local communities, access to fresh food and so on. Unless we start doing working across all of those levels, then we aren't going to make the progress that we need. And while I'm obviously a very strong advocate for the sort of reforms I talked about within the health system, the truth is most of the gains actually lie outside of the health system. Climate change, as I said, unless we start to recognise that there's an urgency there, not just in terms of the impact on the environment, but on human health, then we won't obviously make the gains that are necessary. But big opportunities as well. Big opportunities to get that integration happening, to link up communities, to have healthier environments. But federal government, I suspect, is not where this change will be delivered. I think this change will be delivered at a much more local level.
Thank you, Richard. I'm Tina Donovan from Rural Health West. We're funded to recruit and retain GPs in rural and remote Western Australia. The number of vacancies out there for a rural GP right now is 110. A year ago, it was about 60. Mm. The number of places in the GP training program has been going up steadily over the years, and it's now quite a solid number, but they're still not going rural. 54% of all rural doctors, GPs in Western Australia, got their medical degree overseas, came here as a migrant to work. I can't see the situation changing very much. Do you have any thoughts about how we can encourage people to take up that incredibly rewarding career as a rural GP?
It's a good question. Look, I suspect most of the stuff that I say... workforce is an enormous issue, health workforce, enormous issue. Again, we abolished an agency, dedicated objective around planning a health workforce. That was, again, along with our preventive health agency, the Health Workforce Australia was abolished. I think a backward move, and a lot of that capacity was lost. I don't think there's any sort of magic to this. I mean, you're fighting against trends that mean that there's this increasing urbanisation, but taking more students from non-urban environments, people who come from regional areas, really important. You know that there's a much higher likelihood that some of those people will return. Making sure that there's some exposure through, and that's happening, but perhaps not enough, that people are given the level of exposure to that environment. I'm a product of that. As a result of the exposure I had during my training, I returned to rural general practice. Making sure you've got those incentives in place, and I know that some of the agencies that provide incentives to help people to relocate, induction programs, the supports when people are in those environments. But again, you're fighting against things like, families who might, where education might be a big factor for their kids. And it has to be much broader. It's not just about how do we get graduates to work in regional communities by focusing explicitly on the supports we can provide for them and through their journey as a medical student, but what do we do about our regional communities more broadly? How do we start investing in those places in a way that ensures that they become places that people want to live? And that's broader than just health workforce. I mean, there are a few thoughts.
Dora? Dora Marinova, Curtin University Sustainability Policy Institute. And I just want to follow up on the question that my colleague Laura Stocker asked, which relates to co-benefits or synergies when we are tackling climate change and health at the same time. And a perfect example of this is consumption of meat, and red meat in particular. The World Health Organization classified processed meat in the same group as tobacco in terms of its carcinogenic effect. But we're still running sausage sizzles when we're doing fundraising. We're still consuming way above what is good for our health in terms of not just processed meat, but red meat. And this is an issue that is kind of also hidden in the IPCC latest report on climate change, because when you look at a 20-year horizon, the global warming potential that agriculture has is way above that of the energy sector or transport or building. So is this a too difficult issue to be tackling? What is going on, or why are we replacing mining opportunities with livestock opportunities and this kind of when we have the evidence that we are causing health problems at the same time we are causing problems in relation to greenhouse gas emissions?
Yes, it's a big issue. It's a difficult issue, a very difficult issue. I have to declare an interest. You know, some of you will have seen my kitchen cabinet, and I come from an Italian family, and one of the things that we actually do occasionally is make salami. So apologies. It is a very, very difficult issue. I suppose in answering it, I agree with you. I think we eat too much meat. As a the planet can't sustain what we're doing at the moment. We need to start trying to work towards reducing our meat consumption. How you do that, what are the mechanisms through federal governments that you put in place to ensure that you start moving towards that area? Very, very difficult. The agricultural sector was excluded from any of the climate laws that were introduced in 2010, not because of the Greens. I mean, we'd like to see the agricultural sector become part of the response that needs to happen, but there are some very significant vested interests in Australia that make that difficult. And there's also, I suppose, a historical, you know, Australia's development as a nation, you know, the notion of off the sheep's back and so on, makes it very, very difficult. But I mean, in the broad, I agree with you. I think we have to start recognising that we can't continue to sustain the level of meat consumption that we have. And at an individual level, I think you've got to disentangle that from the notion of should we be eating meat at all, and I think those two things often get conflated. I think, you know, there is a philosophical argument that we can have separately to this, but I think there has to be an understanding and acknowledgement that we have to start curbing production and consumption, and how we do that, I think, is, you know, is very, very difficult.
Thank you, Senator De Natale. Delia Hendrick from Public Health. There's been a move by some private health insurers to try and give their members preferential treatment at GP practices by, you know, paying the GP practices for this preferential treatment. And this has sort of historically been the space, primary healthcare is historically the space of our universal healthcare system. And obviously the reasons why the private health insurers would do this is straightforward, I guess. They want to keep their members healthy and out of hospital, so it's good for their bottom line. But it does compromise sort of the equity within the healthcare system. And I was just wondering if you'd like to comment on this.
Yes, happily. So you're absolutely right. I think both... So if you've got private, if you're a private health insurer, or you've got private health insurance, it's an attractive option. Is it something that is the path that we should be going down? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. In fact, we drafted legislation to prevent it. I think that put enough public pressure on some of the insurers to back away from that. The moment we start saying that private health insurance can cover people for services in primary care, that is general practice, is the moment that we absolutely entrench a two-tiered system. And the consequence of that will be you'll ring your GP up, and your GP might be have an arrangement with Medibank Private, and unless you're a Medibank private client, you might not get to see that GP for another week or two. In fact, some GPs might decide to have exclusive arrangements with some insurers. And you start to get into a very, very difficult space. It also means that, you know, if you don't have private health insurance, you'll be much more likely to have to wait because one of the changes that was being proposed was if you had private health insurance, that you'd be guaranteed access within 24 hours. Well, of course, the flip side of that is that if you don't have it, you won't get that same level of access. So the notion of actually having, I mean, the objective of the insurers is clear. Yes, we get better management of particularly those people who've got chronic diseases. We want to keep them healthy, encourage better coordinated care. That objective is I think, a sound one, but it should be an objective of the public system as well. It should be our objective is how do we better manage chronic disease within the current universal system of primary care, rather than creating a two-tiered system. Because the moment we go down that path, Medicare as we know it is fundamentally gone.
Okay, two questions. John here.
John Memo, Curtin Health Innovation Research Institute. I'd just like to change tack a little bit and raise with you the Medical Research Future Fund, which has been articulated as being a great future source of innovation and translation outcomes for primary care. There was, however, quite a bit of debate in terms of how that fund should be managed and whether it should sit under the auspices of the Research Committee of NHMRC or through this alternate committee pathway. I was wondering if you could perhaps share the Greens' perspective on the Medical Research Future Fund and how you see it translating or evolving.
So it's good, yes. There was a very lively debate at the time. We spoke to a number of the big medical research institutions, and I think there was a view that the fund had a slightly different role and emphasis to the work done through the NHMRC. There was a much stronger focus on the sort of translational research, and that there was some advantage in having a fund that focused on that translational component, which is only a small part of how the NHMRC works. I mean, it's part of what they do, but to have a fund with that dedicated focus in terms of translational research, and also to provide a different avenue and pathway for some of the work that was being delivered. So after having done a lot of consultation on that, we formed the view that firstly we wanted to get it over the line, and the best way to do that was to work with those medical research institutes who were very strongly supportive of having a different administrative structure to the NHMRC. But I'm interested to hear your views perhaps later on.
Richard, may I come back to the Malcolm Turnbull thought bubble on returning income tax powers to the states, or some income tax power to the states. One of the attractions of that for many people was that it was an acknowledgement that Australia is a federal system, and that the states have service delivery obligations far in excess of the revenue access that the Commonwealth allows them. Do you see any scope left in the health field for federalism, for the states to have autonomy in what they do, for perhaps experimenting in some of the different approaches to healthcare that you would like to see tried and so on? Or is the door closed on that as far as the Greens are concerned?
Well, I don't think that the current system prevents innovation and experimentation. I'm not sure that the funding arrangements are the block to that. But, you know, our view is, as I said, that it doesn't make sense to have different parts of the system funded by different levels of government. And I think that's a view that has been broadly shared by most of the people we've spoken to in the space. So from our perspective, I think that if we're going to reform health, then the Commonwealth needs to be a big player in this as a funder. But that doesn't prevent innovation coming out of state governments. I think that they can still do that. And there's the opportunity for partnerships within the current framework. But to simply say, well, what we're going to do is have a system of eight different income taxation systems. We're going to have some states deciding to go down this road of reducing income taxes. States like Tassie, I don't know how they'd cope. I mean, there are so many problems inherent with that, with the idea that, I mean, ultimately, I think it was unlikely to ever succeed. And from our perspective, it's not a model that we support.
I think we advertised to finish at 1:30. It's about 1:30. So can I say on behalf of everybody what a comprehensive tour de force in many respects about the whole health system which has given us. And thank you also for your questions. Yeah.
So that brings us to the end of the formalities. There are some light refreshments and some nibbles outside in the foyer, so I would invite you to please enjoy them in a moment. But before I do, just a couple of quick things. Lectures begin here at 2 o'clock, so we'll be out of the foyer before 2 o'clock, please, or else you'll get roped into a lecture. And finally, some thank yous for making this event happen. Lisa Duplock, who's outside at the moment, from JCIPP, of course. John Mamo and his staff from the Faculty of Health Sciences, the catering and audiovisual staff, and of course Senator Dinitale and Senator Seward's officers. So thank you again. Hope to see you again in another event, and I invite you out to the foyer. Thanks very much. Thank you.